We are pleased to say that after a few years of toiling and working with our external stakeholders and the academia and the technology sector, we have been able to at least beginning to start chip away at the problems that the industry is facing when as it relates to stack testing. By no means we are there, so it's an ongoing conversation, but and I'm sure we'll touch on this later, we have made some strides that are better than where we were, say, 3 years ago. So happy to share those as well.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Give your cattle platinum protection with Virbac Bovagen Platinum Vaccines. Start your protection at us.virbac.com/platinum protection. Data shows most cattle don't get enough vitamin D, which can impact health and performance. High D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Lalamond Animal Nutrition offers microbial solutions to boost animal welfare and performance.
For over 60 years, bioMérieux has been a world leader in diagnostics, now revolutionizing the beef and meat industry with augmented diagnostics. Addressing critical challenges such as food safety risks and recalls, production costs and waste, as well as environmental and consumer concerns, bioMérieux offers a fresh approach that goes beyond test results. Their unique portfolio of microbiology testing, genomics, data solutions, and expert insights help with pathogen detection, enumeration, and root cause analyses. By providing improved risk anticipation and comprehensive data, bioMérieux empowers beef processors to confidently navigate today's complexities.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm your host, Brandi Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the latest trends and issues from the best and brightest minds in the beef industry. Today on this episode, sponsored by bioMérieux, we have Dr. Vic Dutta, Senior Director of Scientific Affairs, and Dr. David Thomas, Associate Director of Scientific Affairs for Food Business, both at bioMérieux. We are going to dive into some of the dirty bacterial details around food science and how it relates to beef. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Dutta and Dr. Thomas. We are very happy for you to be here.
Thank you for hosting us.
Thanks for the invitation.
To start off with, please, if you don't mind, I know that you both have long careers in food science and many stops along the educational path, and I didn't even touch any of that in the upfront. So just to start off with, if you could each briefly bring us up to speed on your background, how you got started in the beef and food industry and your career thus far, and then how you got to bioMérieux, that would be wonderful. So Dr. Dutta, could you start us off there?
Sure. So I am a veterinarian by training, and then I moved on to getting specializations in molecular biology, and then along came the microbiology as well. So I've been working in the field going almost 19 years, and I have experience in the government, in the private sector, as well as a little bit in the academia. And the common thread through all of these different areas that touch upon the food safety is the public health aspect of it. This is why I joined the sciences, life sciences in the first place. And I'm glad to say that I'm continuing to contribute to that mission today.
Wonderful. Thank you. That's what I should have said. Life sciences. That's a better way to encompass the background. So thank you for that. Dr. Thomas, can you please, share your side of it.
Yeah, my background is engineer and food technologist, and I started in the 90s. Indeed, I started in the meat sector, working doing research and development projects in slaughterhouses, working with beef and pork meat for 5 years. And then I moved to the food safety area, leading a microbiological and molecular biology laboratory in Spain, hosted in a research organization, in a private research organization. And after 20 years working on that laboratory, I moved to Switzerland to work in research and development also in a big company from Switzerland. So maybe you can imagine what is the company. And since I moved to bioMérieux, I'm part of the scientific affairs team.
You have been all over. And you were telling me earlier, before we started, about your commute between countries, and that's just very impressive. I find that all very impressive for both of you, your journey through the life sciences and your dedication to science and safety. And so I appreciate, as a beef producer, I do appreciate the dedication to food safety and food science. And as a beef producer and interested in food safety, I'm well aware that the beef industry has invested hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in food safety over the, you know, many, many years. And so your specialty, could you talk a bit about STEC, which is Shigatoxin producing E. coli, and why they are a major concern for the beef industry?
Yeah, so I can get started and I'll let David then follow through. Before we jump into the topic of STEC, which is where we'll spend majority of our time, I would like to take a second and speak to what's happening to the world of food safety, because STEC kind of falls under that in a good way. So the idea of food safety, as we have known it in our grad schools and when we were, you know, coming new to the field, was very hazard based, you know, from the testing to the prevention and subsequent decision making on the operation side. It was all hazard based. And over time, the biggest change that we have seen in the beef sector, and it continues to be seen across the segments in dairy and poultry and so on and so forth, is that the food safety overall is becoming more dynamic, risk-based. And what that means is, you know, the pathogens are evolving, the technologies are evolving, the business is evolving, the technologies that are supporting the business are evolving. So looking at the problem here, which let's just call these dirty bacteria, as you started the podcast with, being the culprit, they're also evolving. So for us to make decision on a static basis, which is what the hazard based thinking is it doesn't serve the purpose. So that kind of has, you know, touched upon the STEC as well. And if you recall, I said a minute ago, STEC is part of this culprit world in a good way. What I mean by that is we know a whole lot more about STEC than some of the other bacteria like Salmonella, even for that matter, Listeria, you know, it constantly continues to pop up. So in terms of the virulence factors, in terms of how to catch this organism, where, you know, where it's found and where it lives and how it's tracking through the facilities, through the environment, we know a lot about this organism. So that's a good thing. Not so good thing is that we as an industry, and I'm putting everybody here in one box, we are yet to sort of catch up to what this organism is doing. And we'll speak to that a little bit more later in the podcast. But I just wanted to set the stage for we are moving from a hazard-based testing to more dynamic risk-based testing and prevention.
Yes, going to Big's point, I think the key point is also the technology. So technology is evolving and is helping to go more and more in detail about what are the risks and then also how to detect it in a fast and easy way and be closer to the industry. So that's for me also important before to start talking about the bacteria, that today the technology is allowing us go close to the line, be in the factory, in the lab factory, and then allowing to take actions and react in a quickly manner with all the information that is required. So this is complementing the risk management on Shigatoxin E. coli and other pathogens.
Okay, so wonderful. But I do know that, like, as a beef producer, I don't want anybody to ever be afraid that what they eat is going to make them sick. I'm sure both of you are aware or know what, you know, in 1993, we had a Jack in the Box outbreak and some little children sadly perished from eating burgers. And we can't ever have that again. And so obviously it's a major concern for the beef industry. But can you speak into a little bit about why are we seeing some major regulatory shifts around STEC? And maybe what's driving those changes and dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, so I'm going to weave in two different. So my point and then what you just said, Brandy, in terms of the historical context, at least for the U.S. And there's a similar stories on other parts of the world as well. And I'm sure David will touch on those. But back in the 1990s, you know, when Jack in the Box happened, our knowledge about this organism, STEC, specifically 015787, which is the primary serotype at the time that was the culprit, was very limited. And so we made the decisions at the time based on what we knew, which is obviously, which is normal. But to your point about what is the challenge, we are realizing that the problem, so to speak, as it relates to STEC is not limited to one serotype. In fact, in the U.S., we ended up expanding that definition of the adulterant to top seven, which, you know, other serotypes are involved. And then, so that kind of provided a larger umbrella towards controlling these organisms. But we are increasingly finding that serotype is not a good definition of controlling STECs. And there is theoretically endless shigatoxins that could be harmful to us. So that is an evolving challenge. And the regulatory agencies and industry alike are worried about this, and they are acting in their own ways, wanting to control or provide a better detection and prevention of evolving Shiga ecology. And I would add additional complexity here is that our supply chains have become more complex. The economic pressures are always evolving. And then also the beef, as we have known it, you know, back in the day, is not the same. You know, there's a lot of other factors that are impacting the bottom line. So in the changing landscape, it is normal for all of us to react and provide newer solutions, or at least perceived solutions. And then coming together of the regulatory and the industry practices, and then what we are doing on the technology side as far as the detection is concerned, and I'm sure there's a whole lot of other companies that are working on prevention, you know, all of us have to come together on a table to really assess what the problem is and how exactly we should be tackling it.
Going to the rest of the world, I would say, and I cannot have visibility about every single country, but my experience in Europe and in some Asian countries is that regulation is not globally aligned. So it's very difficult to fix a global regulation for Shigatoxin E. coli. Some countries like France, they have a specific regulation based in a specific epidemiology and specific foods. And other countries don't have any specific regulation. So I think we need to define two different aspects. One is science and the other is regulation. So science is going upfront and is providing preventive measures and helping to the risk management of STEC. And then we know from science what are the targets, what are the genomes implied in outbreaks, and then we can develop tools to prevent and to identify those risks. Then regulation, at least in Europe, is becoming after the outbreaks and after the problems. So here there is no a common regulation in Europe. But when the regulation is there, is because a big outbreak has been already impacted the population. So, of course, we need to address and we need to follow regulation. But for me, it's the science who needs to drive the STEC prevention and the STEC tools and risk management to be able to prevent and to avoid this evolution that is not usually addressed by the regulation. So STEC is continually evolving. We can see outbreaks almost every month around the world. And every time we can see different behaviors, different profiles, and different foods impacted.
That's very interesting because you've mentioned two challenges already. One came from you, Vic, and one came from you, David, about the problem of controlling it and detecting. And so one is that it's a global issue. It's not something that's just centered in the U.S. And I apologize for earlier centering things in the U.S. The U.S. is not the center of the universe or Earth. And then you, Vic, mentioned that it's always evolving. So are there other challenges that are associated with it detecting and controlling it aside from the global aspect of it, as well as the ever-changing makeup of it? What other challenges are there?
So for me, the challenge are addressed by the literature. So if you see the scientific reports from the World Health Organization with the European Food Safety Agency, we already know what are the risks associated and we already know what needs to be detected. But then if you go to the industrial world, if you go to the real world, you can have a positive result that you cannot react on that, because you can have a very high percentages of positive results that are not associated to risk itself. So for me, that's something that needs to be considered, because you cannot react like another pathogen like Salmonella or Listeria. When you have a positive, you can expect to have a real positive. But here for Zygotoxin E. coli, following the current methodologies, you are not expecting to detect the positive result unless in a very low percentage of samples. When I say low, could be 10 or less than 10% of the samples. So for me, this is a real challenge for the industry, because you need to take actions today and maybe tomorrow, but not in 1 week. And then you need to react and in the result, based on that results that are not always so accurate. So that's for me one of the big challenges to manage the risk.
And I'll go deeper and step back a little bit for folks who are not in the lab. For Zygotoxin, you know, once you have a material that you're testing in, typically ground beef, you know, you would then put it into a broth that would allow the organism to come up in numbers. And so then we provide testing methodologies that would then allow us to do a quick yes-no check to say whether the organism is there or not. And then the other component is, once you do find an early signal of organism being there in the broth, then you have to confirm it. In other words, pull out the colony of that organism, grow it on a plate, and therefore be able to confirm it. And both of those aspects of microbiological testing are critical for decision making. But to David's point, the upfront and the quick nature of decision making from the enrichment is what we call the broth, where the meat is subjected to growth, is probably the more important one, because, like David said, there is decisions that have to be made on the spot. And then you can imagine, if you are having a 90% false positive rate, that causes a lot of problems for the operations. And then you can then take it down to the economics and then the backing up of the operations and all sorts of decisions that have to be made. So that adds to the complexity of the testing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of, we work in very different segments of the beef industry, you two and I, but there's a commonality in the fact that you have to take action when something is bad has happened. You know, when, like, I have a sick animal, it's not something that we can, you know, that my husband and I want to say, oh, let's wait a week and see how it goes. You know, a lot can happen in a week with animal health, and the same on your end, that you don't want to wait a week. We need to protect consumers' health and safety and be able to react quickly. So I can see why that's so concerning. Previously, I used to work for the National Cattle and Beef Association. It's a really large beef trade association here in the United States. And I was on the issues and crisis management. And whenever we would have, you know, on the rare, very rare occasion that we would have an outbreak of a bacterial in some ground beef or something like that. And again, it didn't happen very often, but we had to act quickly, because we had to notify the state that it happened in, or grocery, you know, we had to notify people and work with whatever state association it was and things like that. So it really, timeliness and being able to react quickly is a really, really important thing. And so I'm just wondering if investing in STEC technology, like detection technology, if that can help impact long-term profitability of, like, the overall beef industry.
So I'll go back to what David was saying, to your point, Brandy, that if 9 out of 10 times you're not sure if the problem is a true problem, that is a problem in itself. So the idea of testing should be to make things easier and the operations to go smoother. But when it throws a wrench, so to speak, in the ongoing flow of goods and decision making, that is a problem. So in terms of so we as a company have been working with our partners in the beef industry on European side as well as in the U.S. side, on trying to basically pinpoint what is it that we can do when it relates to this specific aspect of false positives. As both of us have said, we have been working on trying to find technological solutions that would allow for that 9 out of 10. Again, I'm using that as an example. It's almost 9 out of 10. How can we make that ratio smaller, if not make it disappear? And on the back end, when I say back end, I mean when you're pulling out the colonies, the confirmation side, That itself is also very, very complicated because of the complex nature of the biology of stacks. And then, you know, again, the kind of things, the challenges that we discussed in terms of timing and all of that. So so those are the two areas we have pinpointed. And we are pleased to say that after a few years of toiling and working with our external stakeholders and the academia and the technology sector, we have been able to at least beginning to start chip away at the problems that the industry is facing when as it relates to stack testing. By no means we are there, so it's an ongoing conversation, but and I'm sure we'll touch on this later, we have made some strides that are better than where we were, say, 3 years ago. So happy to share those as well.
Well, let's touch on those now.
Okay.
That's important. Let's just dive right into that. Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, so the idea behind this improvement of the method is to include some markers that help to trigger a positive result only if a highly pathogenic E. coli belonging to the top seven serogroups is there. So those markers are associated to some of the strains that will help to you to have a real positive only if the markers are in the same cell, helping to, let's say, reduce the number of positives from the preliminary screening. Why these markers are helping to us is because they are present only if the same genome of the bacteria contains both STX and EIE markers. I don't want to go in detail about the genetics behind Sigatoxin E. coli because it's not an easy topic, but it's helping to colocalize the markers in the same bacteria. So this is the next step. So the markers has been developed by a food safety agency and has been extensively tested in different areas and in different countries and in different continents. So that's also important to know that are not associated to a specific geographic region or a specific food commodity, but are present in the bacteria itself, helping to apply globally these markers to improve the detection and to improve the accuracy of the method.
That seems to address greatly the issue you were talking about earlier, that it's a global problem. If it's been identified in the E. coli organism in many different countries, that must be like a really break, you know, a breakthrough in developing a new technology to detect it. So that sounds like, you know, that's a really big win.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Brandy. And the idea that you're taking out the most problematic STECs, and you're pointing, you know, when you're doing the testing for stacks in a microbiology lab quickly, is a game changer in many ways. And it allows for a quick decision making just when you're doing your regular Shigatoxin as well as Entamin gene testing, you can have this test incorporated on top of that. And then if all three of them light up, we have, through multiple data points that we have collected in bioinformatically, we have done the in-lab trials, we have done different organisms, we have tested beef enrichment throughout the many different labs across the world. They all of them point to a very, very high, I mean, almost 100% correlation between Shigatoxin, Entamin gene, and the genetic markers. So you can almost take that to bank that when you're hitting all three of them, you're running into a problem. And now that provides the surety to the sort of the 9 out of 10 problem that we were talking about earlier. So when you are making those decisions quickly, you're now able to make those decisions super fast in terms of like, okay, we have a problem and we can act on it. We can really segregate this batch or whatever the management practices are and not second guess, like what are we looking at here?
Well, I mean, it sounds as if this goes from a 10%, what's the right word? Confirmation or 10% assurance to 90%. That's a massive swing in assurance that it's actually hitting on what it's supposed to.
I won't go into details there, Brandy, but it's not quite 90%. That's what I meant by we are making improvements.
Okay.
our data says that we're about 60% there. And this is based on, you know, like studies we have done with the ARS group in Nebraska and other studies that are ongoing in, you know, they've been done in France and New Zealand and other places. They're all pointing to about 60% improvement. And this data we are, by the way, we are collecting nonstop to make sure that we are not only just piling on to our understanding, but also learning if there is anything new about sugar toxins elsewhere. The remaining 40%, we are still working on that. But I just wanted to clarify that we have made good strides, but the work remains.
I don't know where I got 90%. I apologize for that. But it's still a big jump. So that's impressive. I'm sorry. I don't know where I got the 90. I was overly excited for the jump. So just to be clear, to make sure that we're kind of all on the same page, are you referring to the PEC, the PEC markers in this instance?
That is right. So PEC, in fact, stands for pathogenic E. coli. But we at BMRU have gotten used to calling them PEC markers. And those are the additional genetic elements that we have found within the stack that provide a colocalization information on Shiga and Entamin. So in other words, if Shiga toxin, Entamin gene is present, and then you also see PEC markers light up, you know that the organism is highly pathogenic Shiga toxin E. coli.
Yeah, and I think it's important to highlight that all those markers that are on multiplex real-time PCR can be conducted together with the first screening. So you can have results at the same time if you wish, or you can do it after the first screening, but it takes 1 hour to have results. So I can see how important it is, because myself, I have been at 4 a.m. in a slaughterhouse laboratory having a first screening positive and then asking what to do now with the products that are being produced in the slaughterhouse, so and the carcasses and all the meat that is there. So with this technology, you can do it again in parallel, or you can take only 1 hour on plus to really confirm that your first positive results are really having or coming from the same bacteria having the high pathogenicity associated to the genome.
And I would like to add, the inverse data is equally good. And what that means is that if you do not see a PEC marker, we have known that the enrichments that were negative for PEC or PEC markers end up getting no pathogenic E. coli confirmed on the back end. And we did extensive work to confirm that. So what that means is that if you are a bee producer and you're making your decisions off of PEC test, a positive is a real problem, and a negative could allow you to release the product. So that is also equally true.
Right. I imagine there has to be some sort of, in BioMérieux, you have your own KPIs for the PEC markers and the testing. But what's the potential? I mean, there is a potential, I feel like, for a really big return on investment with this in terms of not only like time, but there has to be some sort of like tangible income or expense cost here. Can you give an example of that?
Yeah, so I'll go back to the numbers that we were referring to. So let's start with the problem, right? 9 out of 10 times, roughly speaking, I have to keep saying that because it's not a perfect data, right? You are getting a unconfirmed positive. So you have a signal from your broth upfront in the testing. You cannot confirm that. So that is very, very low. Including the PEC into your testing upfront increases that number from 10% to 60%, up to 60%. And so you can see that for the releasing of your shipments, and also in terms of decision making from the lab to the operations, you know, you are that much less concerned. And then also a lot of times we have seen, we are yet to quantify what that number looks like. The impact of not having PEC on the operations is something we have not been able to collect. We are now collecting data in the real world to see what that looks like. But we think there's additional benefits to, so there's not only benefits to pinpointing the problem more accurately, 60% to be specific, but there's also benefits to, you know, making sure that there is no problem and you can release the product. In any case, you can imagine that you as a beef producer are releasing more product, and also ensuring at the same time that you're not jeopardizing anybody's health by accidentally or, you know, unknowingly releasing any product. So both of those aspects, the public health aspect of it and the economics, kind of work together when you include PEC into your testing.
And you can't really put a price on public health.
Exactly.
You know, public health is a person's life. That's priceless. So
a high-functioning rumen drives herd performance, gut health, and profitability. Levucel SC by Lelemon Animal Nutrition is the only naturally occurring rumen-specific active dry yeast probiotic designed to optimize rumen function, boost fiber digestion, and help you get more out of your native rangeland or pasture. No matter how you supplement your herd, include Levucel SC to help your cows grow bigger calves. Discover the right formulation for your herd at ChooseLevucelSC.com.
It's an immeasurable thing because it carries such weight.
To complete Vic's statement that it's important, the public health, for of course, this is not negotiable and this is priceless. But when we go to the taking actions from the laboratory point of view, also it's important to know that in 50% of the cases when you have a positive, you don't need to do anything else. And that's also very important to make a decision and also to make the life easy for the laboratory and the quality managers, because you don't need to go to confirm and spend your time and also your efforts and also your money, because confirmatory tests for Cicatoxin E. coli are really long and expensive. And sometimes you need to send the samples to an external laboratory because biosafety concerns, and then waiting for those results will be long and expensive. So you can take actions in 50% of the cases using those markers. You can avoid those extra steps to finish your question.
Yeah, and it just saves a lot of time, you know, having to wait and retest and retest. You're not having to do that, for sure. Pardon my naivety, is this adopted in, has USDA adopted this testing method with PEC? So that is, it's...
That is correct. We did a lot of trials with the USDA ARS, which is a research division. And they have now recently published a paper, which is, again, an ongoing work for many, many years, where all the statistics that we are citing here, they were, you know, some of them were created there and then eventually confirmed. But, you know, all the statistics is coming from those trials, because for something like this, you know, we wanted to be absolutely sure what we are looking at and the value and quantify all of that. And since then, you're absolutely right, Brandy. Last year, the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service had adopted PEC markers as part of their screen for the STEX, and this is now written in the MLG.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. So with this adoption of the new testing, like, what does that mean for other regulatory agencies that are not in the United States, you know, around the globe? What does that mean for those agencies in the next, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years? What does that look like?
Yes, as I mentioned before, unfortunately, we don't have a global regulation. We don't have a specific regulation to follow in Europe or in other countries, but we have two different aspects. So people exporting beef to US needs to follow the US regulation. Then the markers can help, and indeed we are working with other countries to implement and to do an official validation of the markers to have the method approved for export. And then it's important also to highlight that it's not only regulation, it's also an industry tool. And recently we have a paper from the French Safety Agency with all the document and all the study performed in the beef industry in France with the PEC, with the pathogenic E. coli markers, showing also that the reduction is correct. And we can arrive at 50% of reduction and still be sure that the negative results are real negatives and the positive results in most of the cases are confirmed. So this scientific paper, it's published in 2025 and it's endorsing the methodology for other countries.
So it will, I mean, it's going to influence it. At some point, are other countries going to see this, the results of the trials and of the adoption by the USDA and the paper that you were referencing, David? Does it seem like the other countries, their regulatory agencies will pick this up? Even though there's not a global, one global agency, will individual countries, beef producing countries, kind of adopt it as well?
Well, for me, we need to be very transparent. And for some countries and for food safety regulators, they want to target another aspects of cigatoxin E. coli. So I cannot say the markers are globally adapted to the specific requirements, because every country has a specific epidemiological programs and specific food health requirements. So for me, it's managed by the risk. So if you have a high number of positives that never are confirmed, then your regulation and your risk management allows you to focus on those that are really associated to outbreaks or to public health. And then you can manage with those markers. But if you are not having these issues, and maybe not beef, but other food commodities, they have a very low percentages of cigatoxin E. coli, and they can manage on a general cigatoxin E. coli presence. That for some food authorities is still a risk not to have a big outbreak, not to have hemolytic or bloody diarrhea that can produce cigatoxin E. coli, but to be a, let's say, simple diarrhea. So for me, it's important to highlight that we still need to address local and epidemiological behavior in each specific region.
I can confidently say that no one wants the simple or the bloody of what nobody wants those things.
Yeah. And this, I just want to highlight what David said there is there. This is the dynamic risk that I was referring to at the top of the podcast. It's not one size fits all. It's more like fit for purpose. But I would also say to your point about Brandy, how do we go from here? Part of the reason we are doing this podcast with you today is we don't think that the knowledge should be held back. There is something to be highlighted here. And between David and myself, we are trying to highlight the science and the technology and a possible solution that this brings to the forefront. Now, how does that get implemented, you know, in the regulatory framework in different countries and the risk mitigations, you know, it will vary. But we would like everybody to know that PEC markers exist and there is value to be had. Where it goes from here, and, you know, this is the kind of conversation we are trying to initiate through this podcast.
Again, pardon my naivety. I know one inch deep on STEC, but I am interested in, you know, what other strategies or tools should beef processors, of which I am not a processor, start implementing now so that they can stay ahead of upcoming regulatory changes.
Well, from the diagnostic point of view, I think all people is talking about whole genome sequencing. Today, I don't see this technology applicable in the real industry day to day. So it's a very strong methodology. We at bioMérieux, we are developing and we have a dedicated data and genomics team working on those technologies to do the typification and to work on a specific metagenomics and identification of strains. So that's the powerful tool. Indeed, in Europe, this is becoming mandatory for any outbreak, like it is already in America by the FDA. So this regulation starts in Europe in 2026. But again, this is the state of the art technology for epidemiology and for public health laboratories. But for food industry, we still need to develop and to progress on markers, on easy diagnostic tools that can be implemented in the factory itself. And then, for example, we are also working on the isolation step. It's not the molecular one, but we are developing a very, I would say, fantastic and new technology to isolate cigatoxin E. coli. This is going to be launched this year also, and it's not associated to the markets itself, but to the cigatoxin producing strains. And we think that this will be also a fantastic tool to improve the isolation rate and to improve the possibility to detect and to react on the cigatoxin E. coli presence.
Well, you'll have to come back on when it launches so we can talk about that.
Yeah, I'm a functional genomics geek, and I've never seen a product that combines a molecular biology and the transcriptomics and the proteomics of these virulence factors and make it so easy for anybody to read them in a timely fashion. So yeah, we're very excited about the agar. It's we calling it Shigatoxin E. coli agar. Ideas Tech is going to be the name of the product, but that's like down the road. I would take to your question, Brandy. I would take a more operational role in what is it that the industry can do. This tool exists. So first of all, we are making everybody aware that this exists. And based on their risk and based on their operations and the processes and the rate of positive and the false positive or unconfirmed positive, you know, we just want everybody to know that this exists and they can take advantage of it if they so desire. We don't have to be limiting ourselves to what we have known. You mentioned 1992 outbreaks, and there's others, you know, back in the day. Tools have evolved, and we would like to offer these tools to anybody who is interested. And for anybody, it makes sense from the risk mitigation standpoint to adopt these or use these tools. And we are working with, in fact, a lot of beef processors here in the U.S. to bring this tool to their labs and to laboratories and to see if that helps with their decision making. To me, that's a good place to start. And if they do adopt something like this or end up working with us, you know, like David said, that we are working on additional tools that will then subsequently make it even more handy for the lab to make decisions off of what is really a problem versus, you know, something you can ignore.
I think that's just really speaks to the importance of the issue, because food is multifaceted, and I appreciate that a lot. And for our listening audience, I did put the BioMaryU website in the footnotes. So if you're listening to this on your drive and you want to go on a desktop and look at it or visit it later, that will be available there for you. Again, I want to thank you both for being here. We want to thank BioMaryU for sponsoring this episode. And to our audience, thank you for tuning in, and we'll meet you back here next week on the Beef Podcast.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.